From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins is a thinking person superstar in his native Britain, recently named the country's top public intellectual in the mold of Stephen Jay Gould and E.O. Wilson. Richard Dawkins is also a longtime and unapologetic champion of Darwin's theory of evolution, a Darwin fundamentalist, Stephen Jay Gould once said. Today, a burgeoning movement of American religious fundamentalists disdain evolution, promote creationism, and see the intelligent design of a divine hand in life and the cosmos. Dawkins says no. He calls creationism educational debauchery and proponents of intelligent design lazy. In his new book, The Ancestor's Tale, he relates the epic story of evolution on Earth, tracking the journey backwards to the dawn of life. It is an ancestral journey of billions of years that includes chimpanzees, lemurs, sea sponges, and, says Dawkins, you. Tonight on Point, evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. Listeners, how do you understand the deepest roots of your family tree? What do you make of Richard Dawkins' argument for evolution? Are you ready to embrace your ancestors of 165 million years gone by? What's your question for Darwin's great champion in 2004? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me now from New York is Richard Dawkins, professor of public understanding of science at Oxford University. He is author of several best-selling books, including The Selfish Gene and The Blind Watchmaker. His new book is The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. Good evening and welcome, Richard Dawkins.
Good evening.
It's wonderful to have you, and I'm sure you have very quickly found, coming over to promote the book, that you're landing right in the middle of this ongoing American debate in 2004, in the 21st century, about evolution itself. What does it feel like for you to walk into the middle of that?
Well, it's not a debate that actually goes on in the corridors of science at all. No serious scientist doubts that evolution is true. So it's really a debate between the whole of science on the one hand and a kind of sea of ignorance on the other.
And yet, here it is. The news is out there, whether it's in Atlanta, Georgia, where there's a debate over putting stickers on the science textbook saying evolution is only a theory, or in Wisconsin where there's been a requirement that creationism be taught in science class. Scientists may all agree, but you see what's happening among the American public.
Oh, yes, I'm very familiar with that, and I've met this sticker in the front of textbooks before. I've no objection, of course, to telling children to make up their own minds. I'm all for them making up their own minds. If they're shown all the facts, there's not a slightest doubt that any intelligent child will come down in favor of evolution.
Richard Dawkins, we want to come back and look at that, but it's only fair to do it in light of the terrific story that you tell in this book, The Ancestor's Tale, and what a story it is. And we should give us a sense of what you're up to here, the kind of backward journey through time that you've laid out.
Yes, thank you. First, I should say that, of course, this book is not an advocacy of evolution. It simply assumes that evolution is true.
Very clear.
And so anybody who wants an advocacy of evolution should look at some of my earlier books. This one assumes that it's true, and it looks at evolutionary history. And as you said in your introduction, it does it backwards. So we start with humans, modern humans, and we say, what would our ancestors have looked like 6 million years ago? What were they like? Well, 6 million years ago, they were the common ancestors of ourselves and chimpanzees. I call this Concestor One.
Concestor as opposed to ancestor, because it's the confluence.
It's common ancestor. Mm-hmm. It's the common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. The conceit of the book is that it's a pilgrimage going backwards. Human pilgrims go backwards, and we are joined successively by first the chimpanzee pilgrims at 6 million years, then 1 million years further into the past, we're joined by the gorilla pilgrims, then at 14 million years into the past, we're joined by the orangutan pilgrims, and so on until billions of years into the past, at rendezvous 39, we're joined by the bacteria. In between, we're joined by birds, by fish, etc. So it's a pilgrimage to the past. I like to think an epic pilgrimage to the past, going through 39 rendezvous points on the way to the origin of life, maybe 4 billion years ago. And the link with Chaucer goes further because there are tales.
We haven't really spoken of Chaucer here, but I should just say, you're saying you took the format, more or less, of Canterbury Tales and Chaucer with his pilgrims.
That's right. So where Chaucer had his pilgrims leaving London and going to Canterbury on a three-day journey, and on the way his pilgrims told tales just to while away the journey, on my 4-billion-year journey, the pilgrims tell tales. A pilgrim can't tell a tale until he's arrived. So, for example, the chimpanzees can't tell their tale until they arrive at 6 million years into the past. Once a pilgrim's arrived, he can tell a tale. They don't all tell a tale because there are too many of them. Mm-hmm. But at any one rendezvous, one or two of them may tell a tale. And just like Chaucer's tales, they're not actually necessarily about the teller of the tale. They may be about some more general aspect of life. And, for example, what shall I say, the grasshopper's tale is about the phenomenon of race, largely human race. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be convenient for the grasshopper to tell that tale because there are races of grasshoppers which give rise to interesting questions, and that leads into the subject of human race.
So you've turned evolution around. We're traveling backwards in time. And so instead of the tree of life branching out, going forward, instead there are all these points of junction, of confluence.
Exactly.
All the way back to the original bacteria, you said 3 billion years ago, is that?
Well, maybe more like 4 billion years ago. The oldest fossils are about 3.5 billion years ago, and presumably the origin of life must have been a fair bit earlier than that.
Richard Dawkins, we want to dive into some of the tales that these ancestors or common ancestors describe along the way, and it may be unfair with 40 different pilgrims ultimately marching backward in time. But I wish you'd describe, just so we can get a clearer sense in mind, pick out some of these points at which the human line of descent, if you look at it backwards, meets up with some unexpected characters in the universe of life.
Yes, well, if I look at, for example, Rendezvous 10, that's where the rodents and the rabbits join us. That means that in forward time, at Rendezvous 10, the rodents and rabbits went one way, and we primates,
mm-hmm. parted company.
We monkeys and apes, parted companies. Mm-hmm. Since I'm looking at it backwards, mm-hmm. I don't call it a parting of the ways, mm-hmm. although that's what it was in real time. Mm-hmm. I call it a rendezvous because I'm thinking of it as a pilgrimage. There is a rationale for going backwards, by the way. Mm. It is that if you go forwards and you end up with humans, it makes it look as though evolution was in some sense aimed at producing humans,
yes.
which, of course, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Humans are just one of the millions, tens of millions, of twigs at the end of the tree of life. You could have started with any of them.
So the famous drawing that shows the ascent of man up from ape, Neanderthal, to finally the proud, majestic, upright Homo sapien, you're saying it's not as linear or deliberate as all that.
No, it's not, and that's why doing history forwards can be misleading. But if you start at the end, start with modern times, then you're perfectly at liberty to choose humans as the place where you want to start, because after all, we are humans. So we start there, we go backwards. It doesn't matter where you start. If you go backwards, you always get to the same place, which is the origin of life, which I'm calling Canterbury.
So take us to that point 10, the sort of fork in the river where rodents took a different path from primates. When you
yes.
go back and look at that junction, what's important? What separated these two forks there?
Well, it happened about 75 million years ago. That's an estimate, obviously. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows exactly what happened. Nobody knows exactly what the common ancestor looked like. But the actual moment of separation would have been a population of animals, probably a bit like shrews. A nearest approach today might be something like shrews. A population somehow got divided into two, perhaps on opposite sides of a sea, perhaps mm-hmm. on separate islands. And on one side of the sea, they evolved in a slightly different direction from the other. For the moment, they would still have been just different races. And then a little bit later on these separate islands, they'd have become sufficiently separate that they would be judged different species if we'd been there to judge them. And that means that they could not interbreed if they had met. Once you can't interbreed, mm-hmm. then the way is open for evolutionary divergence to go on, and eventually to give rise to modern rodents on the one hand, rats and mice and lemmings and things, and to modern monkeys and apes, including humans, on the other.
As you say, along the way, you look at different forms of life to bring us tales, something special that they bring. With peacocks, you talk about sexual selection, and you actually come around to human behavior. You talk about the extravagant mating rituals and plumage of the peacock and how that may relate to primates who finally stood upright as humans.
That's right. I mean, quite a lot of the tales actually come back to humans, and that's perfectly fair because that's the purpose of the tales, is to give general lessons.
And we're the ones reading.
Yes. I mean, in the case of the peacock's tale, it's, as you say, it's about sexual selection, which is Darwin's other theory, the idea that what is favoured in selection is those males who are most popular with females. In the case of peacocks, it's those with the most beautiful tails. The suggestion I'm making in the book is that sexual selection may have been important in the evolution of humans, in the evolution perhaps of our nakedness, in the evolution of our big brain, and in the evolution of the fact that we walk on two legs.
You're saying maybe the first time was some male standing up to just show off his genitalia and it caught on.
Well, that wasn't my theory. That's the theory of a woman called Maxine Sheets Johnston. And that's quite a nice theory, but it's not mine. I slightly more generally suggested that some ancestral ape stood up as a kind of display, not to show off his penis necessarily, but just as a sort of gimmick, something that perhaps a display, perhaps
Check this out.
Well, he's thumping his chest or something of that sort. And it became a gimmick which got imitated, rather like a fashion in humans, a fashion for walking, a fashion for wearing clothes or something of that sort. And because it became fashionable, females liked it, and or maybe in the other way around, it may be in a female fashion that males liked. But I don't really want to pin too much on this. This is just one example of a theory. There are lots of other theories. The peacock's tale also discusses the idea that the great enlargement of the human brain, which occurred in the last 2 million years, that may be sexual selection. It could be that one sex was turned on by braininess in the other. Braininess may be a sexually attractive characteristic, some manifested in the ability to speak or to dance or to remember epic poetry or something of that sort.
So many questions for you, and we'll come back to this, but let me just ask, at that first bacteria, or maybe not the first, but 3 billion years back, the bacteria from which, as you've got it, we've descended, were humans and rabbits and sparrows all inevitable at that first moment with the evolutionary way laid before it or not?
No, not inevitable at all. What happened in practice was that the bacteria did eventually give rise to rabbits and kangaroos and humans, but there was nothing inevitable about it. They could have given rise to rather different creatures. In the last chapter, which is called The Host's Return, I do talk about how differently things might have come out. I do think there are probably patterns. If you look at what happens after mass extinctions, for example, after the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, the mammals rather rapidly stepped into their shoes. So although it wasn't inevitable that the mammals would have produced things like lions and camels and pigs, you could say that it's not surprising that they produced a range of creatures somewhat similar to the range that the dinosaurs produced. So whereas dinosaurs had tyrannosaurs, which were large carnivores, and then the mammals produced large carnivores, not as large, the mammals produced saber-toothed tigers and modern tigers, etc. And whereas the dinosaurs produced triceratops and other large herbivores, the mammals produced rhinoceroses and other large herbivores. So there is a certain predictability about the way evolution is going to go after a mass extinction, but inevitable it isn't.
Richard Dawkins, please stand by. We're talking tonight about human evolution, tracing human evolution in reverse, with the best-selling author Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist, author of the new book, The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you understand the deepest roots of your family tree? Can you picture it 165 million generations back? Your mammal-like reptile, the Pilowacosaur? I don't know. You've got some crazy ancestors here. We'll look at them. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about human evolution and the origins of life. My guest is Richard Dawkins, author of the new book, The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. How do you understand the deepest roots of your family tree? Can you picture them 3 billion years back at a bacteria at the beginning of life? And does evolution lead you to a feeling of kinship with the rest of life on Earth, your very distant cousins? Or are you one of the many Americans who today do not believe in evolution? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Richard Dawkins, I mangled the beast here. But 165 million years ago, you've got this mammal-like reptile, the Pilokosaur?
I don't know which one you mean.
Pilokosaur. Oh, gee.
In those Pelikosaur.
Yes, thank you for rescuing me from those three billion years.
Right.
A mammal-like reptile? Where was this in the great chain of things?
Well, mammal-like reptiles were a great flowering of creatures which, actually, you could more or less call them reptile-like mammals. They lived before the dinosaurs erupted as the dominant vertebrates on the planet. Before that, the mammal-like reptiles, again, showed a range of types which were similar to the ones that the dinosaurs were to produce and similar to the ones that the mammals themselves were later to produce. So there were large herbivores and small herbivores and large carnivores, small carnivores, all flourishing on the land, on the continents, before the dinosaurs. And indeed, there were several waves of mammal-like reptiles, and one of those waves eventually gave rise to the mammals, who went into a sort of eclipse, but lived on in a small way, as a kind of trickle of mammals survived right through the era of dinosaurs until they got their great break when the dinosaurs went extinct, when a large meteorite crashed into the Earth and catastrophically wiped out almost everything. But a little trickle of mammals managed to survive, and they were the ones who gave rise to all the modern mammals in a sort of Noah's Ark kind of way.
Richard Dawkins, I wish you'd describe the tool chest that you and evolutionary biologists use today to trace evolution back. It's got some familiar elements, fossils, which have been used a lot for a long time, but now genetics and DNA as well. What's in your toolkit?
Yes, well, fossils, as you say, have been going a long time, and they're still very useful. But even if we had no fossils at all, it's amazing how much we would know about the way evolution has happened. And as you say, it's molecular genetics, which is the really stunning new innovation. Nobody could have dared to hope in Darwin's time, or even right up to Watson and Crick's time in the early 50s, nobody could have dared to hope that every living creature would carry around inside it a detailed digital archive of its own history. And that's essentially what DNA is from an evolutionary point of view. You can take any two species you like, hedgehog and mouse, oak tree and kangaroo, human and amoeba, any two you like, and they've all got DNA, and the DNA is using just the same code, which means that you can literally compare millions of letters of coded information across any two species you like. You can work out how long ago they had a common ancestor, and you can work out the entire, in principle, you can work out the entire family tree of life. It only requires an immense amount of work to look at all the sequences, but in principle, we now can know literally the entire family tree of life and even put dates on it.
As though scribes with each generation have been writing it out again so that it stayed up to date.
Precisely.
Over
it's
those
just
billions.
Almost too good to be true.
Pretty incredible tool. I want to begin to turn to our callers. Rob is calling from Racine, Wisconsin. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Richard Dawkins.
Hello.
It's an interesting show because, I mean, obviously there's so much speculation that goes along with evolution. The study of it, I mean, deals with such large spans of time that I'm wondering, have you ever doubted this theory of evolution? I mean, just all the time that you're talking here and
Rob, let us understand your question, where you're coming from. Do you doubt it, Rob?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's too far-fetched to believe that all this chance just occurred and here we are.
Richard Dawkins?
Okay, let me say two things. First, it's not chance. Evolution is not a theory of chance. That's the biggest misunderstanding assiduously put about by creationist propaganda. Let me say it again. Evolution is not a theory of chance. Natural selection is about as non-random as you can possibly imagine. Now, the caller very rightly says that there's a lot of speculation, and you find a great deal of speculation in the ancestor's tale. But this is speculation about details. It's speculation about exactly what happened when. And of course, there's an enormous amount of doubt about the details. There is no doubt whatsoever that evolution itself is true. Absolutely no doubt that all living creatures today are cousins of each other. You are a cousin of a warthog, you are a cousin of a roe deer, you are a cousin of an oak tree. That is a fact. What's not known for certain, is exactly how long ago the common ancestor that you hold with each one of those creatures lived. That is open to doubt, speculation, and argument. But the fact that you are a cousin of those creatures is no longer open to doubt.
Rob, I wonder if you, why are you still doubting, given the firmness with which this, you know, highly educated scientist and all the scientists around him say this is the way it is?
Yeah, I mean, just because we all have traces of DNA, to me, points out, okay, we all started from the same design, same creator had the intent of each of us having same makeups, not, you know, all of a sudden we're assuming similarities, and it's like, wow, we all must be linked somehow. I mean, I'll give it, we're all linked.
Okay,
but, Richard,
I mean,
Dawkins, thanks, Rob.
Let me just encourage you to look at the details. You'll find them totally fascinating. They really are. Look at the details. Read either this book or another book, and you'll find it riveting, entirely fascinating, and I believe if you actually study it yourself, you'll come to the conclusion that it's totally convincing. I really do.
Richard Dawkins, let me ask you, you've written that, I'm paraphrasing here, but that often people look at this great expanse of time and how much life there's been and how complex the story is, and they quail before that and turn to religion. But you say that religion always looks too narrow to you, having studied it in depth. Even religion doesn't look big enough to contain this.
Yes, that's what I feel. I feel that religion is something that in medieval and pre-medieval times people found a satisfying way to explain these things. It's, of course, superseded now. But not only is it superseded, we can now see that it's actually small. It's small-minded and petty, just not big enough to do justice to the grandeur of the real world as science is now uncovering it. And so that, again, I would encourage people to actually look at the science and see how magnificent the real world is and how pokey and parochial and small-minded is the religious explanation which is now superseded.
Steve's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Good evening. I'm calling because I think Richard Dawkins has done a great job explaining why the anti-evolutionists are wrong. But I'd also like to raise the point about they're not just wrong, but they're dangerous. And what I mean by that is in a time when we're moving to a DNA-based or genetic economy, and in a time when we're all threatened by bioterrorism, the very thought of teaching intelligent design or other forms of creationism to children is just dangerous and ludicrous. I'm surprised that we're in the position of having to face this threat. But I think that I applaud Richard Dawkins for the fight he's done against this. But I think that this has to move to for people that are worried about this. It has to move beyond scientists.
Steve, it's a good point, Richard Dawkins.
That's a fascinating point. I'm reminded, actually, of the parallel case in the late 50s when the Russians launched the first satellite in orbit around Earth, the Sputnik. And that was a real wake-up call to American science, and or rather American science education, because the government in America suddenly realized that they're in danger of falling behind, but they had no idea that the Russians were so advanced in rocket technology. And so a great effort was put into science education in America as a direct result of the Sputnik. Now, you, the caller, have raised a parallel case with DNA technology, which, as you say, is immensely important and technologically important and potentially very dangerous. And so it could be that this could be another wake-up call, that people should be learning about DNA, learning about evolutionary science for the same kind of reason as in the 50s. There was this wake-up call about physics and engineering.
Steve, thanks for your call. Richard Dawkins, we want to learn some more about the tales that you're telling in this reverse history of evolution. Give us some other great tales, whether it's the seal or the grasshopper you mentioned on race. Give us some more insights along the way.
The elephant bird's tale, the elephant bird is probably the origin of the legend in the Arabian Nights of the rock, this giant bird, a colossal bird, two or three times as big as an ostrich. There are a number of giant birds around the world on islands, the moas of New Zealand, the emus of Australia, the ostriches of Africa.
On islands? And,
well, when I say islands, I mean islands in the broad sense. Of isolated pockets of life. The reason islands is relevant is that the reason these animals evolve separately is that they are separated. And the elephant bird's tale is actually a tale about plate tectonics, about continental drift, the way the continents broke away from, in the case of the southern hemisphere, the great southern continent of Gondwana. So what happened was that on Gondwana there were ancestral giant birds, flightless birds. Mm. And then Gondwana broke up and Madagascar went one way, India went another way, Australia went another way, Antarctica, South America and Africa. And on all those places except Antarctica, the large flightless birds evolved differently. So the flightless birds are just telling the tale. What the tale is actually about is plate tectonics, the almost unbelievable story, but now definitely true, that geologists have worked out really in the last half century of how the continents move. South America was once joined to Africa. India was joined to Madagascar, which was joined to Africa. They were both joined to Antarctica and to Australia. It's an astonishing thought that these continents have been inching their way apart at a rate that's been compared to the rate at which fingernails grow. But so vast is geological time that you now see how far away South America is from Africa, how far away India is, how far away Australia is, etc.
And you make clear in the Ancestor's Tale that this process of evolution is by no means finished. It goes on. Where does it go?
There's no reason to suppose that it's finished, of course. It will go on. Nobody knows where it's going to go. The most likely thing is that before the next 20 million years or so is up, there'll be another mass extinction. Mass extinctions come approximately that often. And so if there is a mass extinction, probably we'll go with it, then there will be another flowering of life. Who knows where it'll come from? After the dinosaurs, nobody would have predicted that it would have come from the little tiny mammals, little nocturnal, scurrying, whiskery things that had really no major part to play at all before the dinosaurs went extinct. When the mammals go extinct, who knows what will then take our place? It would be fascinating to know. Of course, we never shall. That's the nearest I come to predicting anything. I would predict that the same pattern of biological types will tend to recur, but I wouldn't begin to try to predict the details.
Richard Dawkins, author of The Ancestor's Tale. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Richard is calling from Cary, North Carolina. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom, and thank you, Professor Dawkins, for being a voice of reason here in the Bible Belt of the United States.
What's on your mind tonight, Richard?
Yes. Well, I actually, as fate would have it, I've got two books by my nightstand here tonight. One of them is The Ancestor's Tale, which I'm about halfway through because it's a pretty
it's a hefty book.
and in addition to that, I'm reading Ray Kurzweil's Fantastic Voyage.
Oh, yes. He's joined us. Very interesting book as well.
Yes. And it just occurred to me, I wonder, you know, in looking at the both of your contributions to science and thought, Professor Dawkins, you've thought about, you know, what your thoughts or predictions are about when or if humans, through our, you know, kind of understanding of our growing understanding of the human genome, if we'll be able to influence our evolution going forward.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks very much, Richard Dawkins.
Yes, that's very interesting. I suspect that if we do survive for a very long time, people may look back on today, on our time, as a great watershed event in evolution. It's the moment at which evolution ceased to be purely unconscious and directed by natural selection and started to become directed by deliberate design. Because it certainly is possible that future evolution under the influence of humans will be deliberately steered, deliberately designed in directions that we want. And that means that for the first time ever in the whole 4 billion year history of evolution, it has a chance of being directed by foresight, actually looking ahead to see what might be a good thing, not just for short-term survival, which is the only thing that has ever influenced it in the past, but in the influence of the long-term survival of the whole species, the whole world, the whole ecosystem.
Let me ask you.
Never happened before.
Do you think that the human brain, the human intellect, is sufficient to effectively steer its own evolutionary path in a way that increases its success, given all the random factors out there?
I think that the science will be there, the technology will be there, if the will is there to do it in a way that the whole of humanity wants. The technology could achieve it. I think the politics would be much harder. I can't imagine that it would be easy to get any kind of agreement about the direction of future that we would want to steer towards.
I guess the question is, given how difficult it is to foresee the future, even if human intellect was fully applied and acted upon, trying to design a more evolutionarily successful line, is it likely to be successful, or are we likely to be surprised despite our best efforts if that unfolds?
I think very likely to be surprised. I mean, we've already, of course, been doing it in a mild way for the last few centuries, the last couple of millennia maybe, because we have produced breeds of dogs out of wolves. I mean, I suppose most people know that a Pekingese is a modified wolf, but breeds of cows, breeds of horses, breeds of maize and wheat and things. So we can already do it, but already you get surprises. When you start to breed wolves to become Pekingeses or to become bulldogs, you breed for things like snub noses, and you find that there are all sorts of undesirable side effects that you didn't anticipate. And doubtless the same would happen with any future breeding programs. Bulldogs, I understand, have difficulty being born other than by caesarean section. Again, mistake in you could say a mistake in guided evolution.
In breeding, something to watch out for. Richard Dawkins, author of The Ancestor's Tale, is with us. You can join us tonight. What's your question about the origin and evolution of life? And can you accept that you are not the final word in evolution? We recorded this earlier, so we're not taking calls this hour, but there's a lot more to come. Stick with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist and author of the wonderful new book, The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. What's your question about the origin and evolution of life? Can you accept that you may not be the final word in evolution? And is there a place for God in a conversation about evolution? Sarah is calling from Case City, Virginia. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. I believe that God invented genetics and that Darwin just observed it. I believe God uses the DNA of the creatures that exist to create new creatures by mutations, and then the fittest survive. The question seems to be whether God used dust to create man or a creature that already existed. But this, in my mind, is the same thing, because we're all made from dust and we all return to dust. So,
well, dust to dust is the metaphor in the Bible, and we do return to dust. But why do you say God instead of a scientific process, Sarah? I'm just curious.
Well, God created all of existence, and when we see a pattern in existence, we see God's plan. So I think God created us using materials that he created and using processes that he created, and that is DNA and the laws of genetics.
Let us pick it up with Richard Dawkins. Sarah wants to take it right back to who created everything, Richard Dawkins. How do you address that?
Well, first of all, I think I want to say that if God did it the way she says, then God took an awful lot of trouble to make it look as though it happened the way scientists say. In other words, God is a kind of con man who is creating an illusion that evolution happened exactly the way Darwin
said. The evidence
of
those billions
of years.
If that's
the kind of God you want to believe in, then you're welcome. I'd also like to point out that respectable theologians, from the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury down, all believe in evolution. Talk to any educated theologian and you'll find that they all believe in evolution without any problem at all. I would recommend a book by Kenneth Miller called Finding Darwin's God, which is one of the best refutations of so-called intelligent design that I've read. And Miller is a deeply sincere Christian.
Richard Dawkins, you know this comes up again and again. You personally are an atheist, but you must know scientists who are not. How does the idea of God, I don't know, intersect with the work that you do, the thinking that you do? Is there a place for it at all in your life and the life of other evolutionary biologists?
Well, I know a great many scientists who are atheists, and I know rather fewer scientists who are religious, but there are certainly plenty of both. So there's obviously no absolute contradiction. I just mentioned Kenneth Miller as one. There are religious scientists and there are atheist scientists. My own point of view is, to answer your question, it's fairly bound up with my thinking as an evolutionist. It was the fact that when I finally understood about evolution at the age of about 15 or 16, that drove me to become an atheist. But other people, of course, have different reasons. I mean, that's because my main reason for being a Christian before that was that I was convinced by the argument about the complexity of life. And if that's the reason why you're a Christian, then forget it, because evolution is going to has already got rid of that argument. But there are, of course, other arguments. People have deep faith because they feel that they've had a personal experience of God. That's another matter. That's not going to be destroyed by learning about evolution at all. So evolution will only destroy your faith if your faith is based upon spurious arguments about the complexity and elegance of life. If that's why you believe in God, then that'll be destroyed by evolution. But if you have a personal faith based on revelation, that won't be destroyed.
George is calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Hi, George, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Professor Dawkins. It's a pleasure and honor to speak with you. I just wanted to just state most people, I feel, in the USA are living at point 10 under Professor Dawkins' categorization at the juncture of rabbits and rats, hence the rise of Playboy and Enron. But no, I just was joking. My question really is surrounding the search for life on Mars or Europa and how that may alter or impact the debate of evolution or your thoughts or predictions on this effort.
In other words, life beyond Earth. Richard Dawkins?
Yeah,
wouldn't it be exciting? It would be immensely exciting. I very much hope they will find it. If they do, the first question to ask is, does it have DNA and does it have the same genetic code as we do? If it has the same genetic code as we do, then it's pretty well got to mean that it's a cross-infection of some kind, which would be, I suppose, much less exciting. If it's got a completely different kind of genetic system, if it doesn't have DNA at all, for instance, then that would mean that it really is a completely separate life form. And that would be the most exciting scientific discovery probably ever.
And does your study of evolution of life on Earth lead you to lean one way or another on the question of life elsewhere, Richard Dawkins?
No, not really. I think what does cause me to lean in some direction would be the question asked by Enrico Fermi, the great physicist, who said, "Where is everybody?" By which he meant, if there is life all over the universe, and some of it is intelligent life, by now we ought to have had a visit, at least by radio, if not by actual bodies. And we never have been visited, and we've never picked up any kind of radio signal, despite fairly strong efforts now to find it, which suggests that if there is life elsewhere in the universe, it's probably rather well spaced out. My guess is that there are islands of life. The universe is such an enormous place that you could have quite a lot of islands of life and yet none of them would ever know about each other, which is a sad thought, but that's, I think, what's looking increasingly likely.
George, thanks for your call. Richard Dawkins, you start off saying that there's not a kind of any definite progressive direction to evolution, but you By the end of the book, you come around to describing a sort of directionality in spite of that. Could you describe that?
Yes, the sense in which there's not a directionality is the sense in which some people want there to be, which is a progression towards humanity. That there isn't. However, I think if you do look at what happens cyclically and recurringly, especially after mass extinctions, you do see the same pattern developing. For example, if you look at the development of complicated organs, like eyes and ears and brains and limbs, there's a recurrent tendency to get progressively better. When the first eye arose, obviously it could hardly see anything at all. It might have just been able to tell the difference between light and dark. Mm. And nowadays we have eyes, I mean, human eyes are pretty good, they're not the best, eyes of humans or eyes of birds of prey, which can form exceedingly sharp images in colour, with a variable focus, with a stopping down mechanism to control the light entry. These are very, very sophisticated mechanisms, which can only have come about by a gradual, progressive improvement. And By progressive, I mean progressive over many, many generations. So whenever you see something really, really complicated, like an eye, the kind of thing that couldn't possibly have come about by chance, the only way it could have come about is by gradual, progressive improvement. And that seems to me to be evidence in itself that evolution is, at least in part, progressive.
Even though we come to these great times of extinction, which can wipe out an awful lot of progress.
Of course, they wipe it out, but then that opens the door to a new phase of progress.
I've got to ask you, Richard Dawkins, you take this enormous view of life. You're encompassing 3-4 billion years here. How does that impact your view of contemporary life, of contemporary politics issues? Does it all seem immaterial, irrelevant to you in the vast scheme of things? Do you even care about political issues one way or another?
I do care about them, but it's a commonplace that when you do take a look at the vastness of geological time or the vastness of astronomical space, it does rather cut human affairs down to size, and that, I think, has got to be healthy.
Healthy, but still, you're fully engaged in the moment, even though you've got this 3-billion-year frame around it.
Well, I'm human, and I live in a particular society at a particular time, and it's very difficult not to be involved in it. But I must say I find it strangely consoling in a dark time of politics to think that in the broad sweep of things, modern politicians are going to go the way of all flesh, and rather soon.
So give us a year number here. If evolution takes its regular or irregular course, how many millions or I don't know what unit years from now would human beings be unrecognizable to themselves or their successors?
Well, I wouldn't like to look into the future, but if you look into the past, if you go back 1 million years with humans, you'd be looking at Homo erectus, which had a considerably smaller brain than us, probably would not have been able to interbreed with us. If you go back 3 million years, then you've got Australopithecus, which had a brain the size of a chimpanzee, but walked on its hind legs.
There we are on that reverse pilgrimage again. Richard Dawkins, it's been wonderful having you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Dawkins, professor of public understanding of science at Oxford University and author of the new book, The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, why one scientist has chosen to teach evolution at a fundamentalist Christian college. This is On Point. A recent Gallup poll says that only 1/3 of Americans regard Darwin's theory of evolution as well supported by empirical evidence. Microbiologist Richard Colling is working to change that perception by winning over some of evolution's toughest critics, fundamentalist Christians. A devout Christian himself, Colling teaches biology and evolution at Olivet Nazarene University, a fundamentalist Christian college in Bourbonnais, Illinois. Unlike many secular scientists, Colling believes that evolution is not necessarily godless and that his faith is heightened, not diminished, because he believes in evolution. In this radio diary, Richard Colling explains how he reconciles his religious faith with his teaching of evolution.
Whenever one raises the word evolution in any Christian context, my experience has been that eyebrows are raised immediately. And the range of responses that come from teaching science at a Christian institution and acknowledging that evolution is a part of God's process in that context, it's different for many people, and they're not very receptive to it overall. So you get responses that are sometimes just ignoring you. You sometimes get responses that are a little more aggressive and that they start writing letters. And then you actually have some much stronger responses, which we probably shouldn't talk about. When I consider myself as a Christian, it's just an individual who believes that God is real and that we follow the teachings of the scriptures and as best we can. And as a scientist, I think there really is no contradiction there. We simply attempt to describe the physical world as best we can. And that, I don't really see any conflict in that sense between a Christian scientist's view and a secular scientist's view. I think we're both searching for the same thing. I have seen relationships ruined on this issue, and that bothers me because I just don't think it's necessary. And I think that there's a sense that both science and faith have tremendous value to give to all of us. And anyone who closes his or her mind to one of these domains and to the exclusion of the other automatically misses out on half of the richness that life has to offer. The way that I find that religion and science go together is to understand that each of them exists in a specific domain. They really, I think, are both important aspects of our existence. Spiritual aspect is certainly very important to many people. And, of course, the physical aspect, all of us are involved in that. And so the way that I approach this is really quite simple. It's a very simple way of looking at the thing is to simply say, whatever is true, claim it. So if you are a person of faith, you say, whatever is true, we can accept that. We can attempt to incorporate that into our paradigm and our understanding of how our faith interacts in our everyday existence. And so using that phrase, whatever is true, accept it, claim it, and integrate it, finds, I think, that it can be used for both science and faith equally.
Richard Colling is a microbiologist and author of the new work, Random Designer, created from chaos to connect with the Creator. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.